All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of Self-Directed. Today, we're going to have another fun conversation with a returning guest, Seth Marlowe. Seth has been with us before. Seth is a very special guest. He's the father of a Praxis alum, but he's also got a great track record, nearly three decades, not to age you, in the corporate world.
You just did.
Everything you just did. From the bottom of the ladder all the way up to the top has been in a bunch of different positions across sales, marketing, customer support, leadership positions, has been on the other side of the table, and also has two daughters, neither who have college degrees, but are both crushing it, and has a lot of perspective to offer about that journey, as a parent, as somebody who's watched his kids. But also been a coach to them and guided them into their journey as they've succeeded in this first chapter of their career. So, Seth, welcome to the show again.
Thanks, Mitchell. I was actually one of the worst girls softball coaches ever for about 6 years. So if you want to talk about that, one of my kids could talk to you about that. Yeah. So you said coach. I'm just saying.
But is that on your LinkedIn?
No, I'm not putting that on my LinkedIn. We only put our successes on LinkedIn, not our failures.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, Seth, I wanted to just tee you off here, and I wanted to get kind of the quick summary. What are your daughters up to these days?
So our oldest daughter, Lauren, is 24. She lives in San Diego. She's what's called a UX UI designer for United Airlines. So she helps design, how systems are going to help employees at United Airlines do their jobs in a more efficient way. So a good example would be she designed the way that a flight attendant is going to take a credit card for payment on a plane when you buy a sandwich. So they use an Android. What's that app going to look like? How many screens is it? What are the buttons? How's it all going to work? So she was the lead designer for that. She loves it. She loves San Diego. She loves her job. Loving her life, really. And then our second daughter, Brooke, is 21. They're so different, as all of us who have kids are. One kid is 3,000 miles away in San Diego, and the other kid, if I could hit a driver straight, I could probably hit her house with a golf ball. That's how close she lives to her parents. Has a dog. Has a great boyfriend that we love, and she's a full time nanny. Makes cakes on the side, and for a while made candles on the side. And she's just loving it too. She's super happy. I just had lunch with her Friday, and she's always fun to be around.
That's awesome. I love to hear it. And one of the things that I love about, hearing their stories, and we've had conversations ongoing for, probably a couple of years now, about your daughters, spurred on by, some of the things Lauren was doing as an alum of Praxis. But one of the things that I love is that they're both successful in their very own unique ways, and it's never been a conversation about like how much money or how impressive is my job title or how fancy is the corporate title or anything that I feel like is the typical kind of metric that I hear young adults feeling the pressure to like go out and achieve success along these specific dimensions. And it sounds like they're both very happy, leading fulfilling lives. And I mean, that's my perspective, at least from our conversations.
Well, I mean, as a parent, that's all, like, it's really good to hear you say that. That was really the goal all along is, I just really, if I tried to net it out, how do I raise a really confident and empowered human being who is ready to start a journey of personal fulfillment? That is pretty much it. I talked to both of them for a few hours yesterday because I was like, I don't want to overstate anything, and I don't want to make up things in my head that I think I said 15 years ago. So I did try to, I tried to get some feedback from them to use for this, but they both talked about that there was absolutely no, like, I want you to be a certain type of job, I want you to earn a certain amount of money or your title or what school you go, or that any of that was important. Honestly, I just didn't care. I really just want you to have the confidence and feel empowered, which is a little harder a lot of times for girls. I think I learned that early on and they told me that, but that's sometimes harder for a young woman at 17, 18, 19 to feel like she has the confidence and the empowerment to go out and do that. But that was really the goal. That really was. So to hear you say that means a lot.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. I was definitely going to ask you what your goal was, but I want to ask you too, like, was that the goal from like day one, or do you feel like kind of as a parent, sort of your understanding, your goals, how you define those goals, those changed over time in terms of like thinking towards the future when your daughters were young, what, you know, what their futures would look like. Do you, did your kind of picture and thought of that evolve over time?
I think it definitely did. I, you know, we, Lauren and I joined you for a podcast about a year ago, and we talked a little bit about that. I read a book when Lauren, you know, was 5 or 6 years old. I can't remember exactly, but it was called The World is Flat. And it was about just how the internet was changing everything. And that podcast, I talked a little bit about that. So my mindset started to change a little bit there. But yeah, I think my mindset started to change when the girls got it, when Lauren, you know, being the oldest, got into middle school and into eighth, ninth grade, and parents, being around parents where you're no longer the parent of a kid. You're like a parent of this being who is about to enter high school. And when you're in high school, it's about where you're going to go to college, and where you're going to go to college is about like what you're going to be when you grow up. And it became like these conversations started to become about that. And so I think when that started to become the conversation, it certainly started to cause my wife and me to take time to say like, okay, so what are we trying to raise here? Mm-hmm. And what directions are we trying to point them in? And certainly I was much more of I would say maybe a little bit more traditional up until teenage years. And then from there, maybe started to change a little bit.
Yeah. That's awesome. Do you feel like, you know, as they were preparing for the real world, were there specific directions you gave them, or a set of, you know, like were you overly liberal in the freedoms, or like what was the structure? You know, you're raising two teens, you're helping them as much as you can prepare for sort of the next step after high school. What do they do? Like, what did that parenting structure look like?
Yeah, that's one of the things I asked them yesterday. Like, if you had to look back and kind of recall your childhood, and then a little bit of comparing your childhood to others, like, what did we do as parents that was different? And different doesn't mean better. Like, what was different? And I think a few things that they brought up were there were a lot fewer rules. They neither one of them ever had a curfew. You know, they're just and again, there's a lot of parents who like, that's terrible. Like you have daughters and they're going to, you know, bad things are going to happen to them. So
some kids probably don't deserve curfews either. I think back to like myself at age 16.
There were times they didn't. I mean, it's that just because they didn't have curfews didn't mean they always made good decisions about what time.
Yeah.
At home, okay. Yeah. But yeah, I think the first thing they said is, and this was definitely something I think my wife and I talked a lot about, really there weren't rules on grades. There really wasn't rules on work ethic, and you have to have a job, or you need to excel in athletics, or, you know, you're gonna have a curfew. I think it was, I guess maybe to sum it up, it was kind of like, they're only going to be kids once, and they can deal with all of this pressure and all of this stuff later and just be kids for now and have fun. I think the second thing is, like, in return for there not being a lot of rules, there's going to be a few rules, and those rules are non-negotiable. Like, you're going to be respectful. You're going to be honest. You're going to communicate with us. You're going to seek guidance for decisions, and you're not going to get punished around breaking rules. As long as you're open and transparent and honest, then you'll get that back. And I think there's times when that didn't necessarily work perfectly, but I think over time, they both commented to me yesterday when I asked them that was very different than what they felt like they saw in some of their friends, and that their friends, I think they really said there's two things they saw in terms of, you know, when I was thinking about us versus friends, one was like grades and rules.
Yeah,
they really felt like there, especially in high school, there was this huge emphasis on grades. There was reward systems for it, punishment systems for it, et cetera. And the second thing was they just didn't feel like a lot of their friends had really transparent conversations with their parents. They hid a lot from their parents. And again, they hid stuff from us as well. But I think the big stuff we covered.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, it's definitely wildly different than a lot of what I encounter talking to young adults about, you know, the pressures of high school, the pressures of impending graduation, like what happens afterwards. Like, I got to make good grades, because if I don't, I won't get into good college. I'm going to be a failure. Like, there's so much built up. I think a lot of that comes from parenting.
Stress. I think that's the other thing they mentioned yesterday. You say that is that they just said it just felt like my friends were 16 and 17 years old, and they were so stressed out.
Yeah.
So stressed out about their grades, or breaking a rule, or how to get away with something, or what college am I going to get into, or what my parents expect of me. And again, I really, what I would hope, like, I don't want people to feel like well, what we said is we expect nothing of you. That really wasn't the point, right? Is that I just back to sort of like, there's a few things we're going to expect and those are non-negotiable. And the rest of this, like, there's going to be plenty of time to figure that stuff out.
Yeah. Did you have any kind of conversations in those teenage years, especially as they got closer to graduation, about like, what are you working towards longer term? Were there any kind of expectations, I guess, towards here's what success looks like on the other side?
I think it was really less about what success looks like on the other side. And it was more about what's the first thing that you're going to try. Mm-hmm. So high school is pretty regimented. You know, you go Monday through Friday, you wake up at the same time, you have classes, whatever. They're just scheduled. Once high school's over, then what? Yeah. And that doesn't mean what's the career that you're going to end up with or anything. It's what are you going to do then? And again, you and I kind of talked about this in the podcast a year ago. Lauren kind of knew that at 15. She never really wavered. She found this program called UnCollege when she was 15. And at the age of 18 in August of 2016, she went to UnCollege. Like she knew that for 3.5 straight years.
Yeah.
Brooke was different. Brooke, you know, I asked her yesterday, Brooke did go to college. And her answer when I asked her yesterday, like, what was going through your mind then? Like, why would you say you most decided to do that? She's like, I did not know what else to do. I really had no idea what to try to do. It's what all my friends were doing. And I know, like, you and mom were saying, like, you don't have to do this. You can do something else if you want. It's your choice. And it just felt like an easy choice.
Yeah.
But she said within probably 6 to 8 weeks, 2 months of her first semester, it's like, okay, this isn't really getting me anywhere. I'm not going to do this. So she dropped out. And then even then, it probably took another 6 months before she really started to figure it out.
Yeah.
But so it really wasn't, to kind of try to answer the question, maybe it was really not at all about where's it all going to end. It was really more about where's it all going to start.
There's an expectation of like the work you're going to have to put in to go figure it out, but not the destination of where you have to end up.
It's daunting. If you're trying to figure out where you're going to end up, man, that's a really hard one.
Yeah.
It's impossible to know. And there's so many different ways that it can take. I think it can overwhelm you a little bit, but trying to figure out if you graduate high school in June, what are you going to start doing in August? That's a little easier to deal with.
Yep. Yep. Taking it day by day and month by month. I think that, man, in the culture we live in today, and this has been going on for quite some time. I know that this was even the prevalent culture when I was in high school is like, this pressure to have your entire life figured out. And at 17 and 18, you're just so entirely, almost embarrassingly ill-equipped to make those types of decisions. You don't even know.
See, we can say that because we're not 17 or 18.
But not now. Or 18, you keep... yeah.
No, I'm saying when you're 17 or 18, you don't want to admit that you're embarrassingly unprepared.
I know. I had it all figured out as 10-foot tall and bulletproof, but...
I know.
You know, as you think back,
it's funny, and one of those things too, I think, yes, I totally agree with that. I think there's sort of this, you know, well, they need a plan, right? So all you're worried about is what they're going to do in August. Like, what's their plan? And I don't know. I look back on my life. It's hard for me to think of a single plan that worked out the way I thought it would. I just kind of felt like that's overrated. I think life's a lot more random than that. And so I just didn't really worry about the plan that much.
Yeah.
Just kind of like if you just do certain things and you do them the right way, it leads to something. And then when it leads to that, you do that. And then once you start doing that, you might do that for 5 years or 10 years, or you might do that for a few months. So then you might want to do something different.
Yeah.
So
I wanted to ask you, how were you as a student in high school, college? Like, what was your kind of education background?
Yeah, my mom was a high school math teacher, and I went to school at a private school because she was a teacher there. Mm-hmm. So I went to one of the most prestigious private schools in Charlotte because my mom was a teacher and I got to go for free. But I went with a bunch of kids they didn't have to have their parents there as teachers to get to go. I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
So my mom was an academic, and, you know, so academics and schoolwork were very, very important. Mm-hmm. She pressed and pressed and pressed and tried to make it important to me. So I would say as a student, I underperformed my capabilities. I was a lazy student. I wasn't a really driven student. I didn't work very hard at too many of my classes. And that continued into college. I had an academic scholarship, a small academic scholarship at a college called Appalachian State University that I lost after the first semester, which did not make the parents happy.
yeah.
And I really didn't start working hard at school, if you're going to call it school, until graduate school. Mm-hmm. So I was a mediocre student.
Yeah, but so what? The reason I want to ask you that is, like, how much would you say, you know, of your corporate success really had anything related? Like, how much of that had any relation to your academic rigor, if you will, your success as a student?
Oh goodness!
And I set you up, and I'm bringing that up because I also want to. What I'm interested in hearing about is, like, your experience as a student and as a professional. You've achieved success. You're an underperforming student, you said. Like, how much of that bled into your ideas as a parent who's helping your young adults decide what to do?
Okay.
And like, what to prioritize as a teen and young adult?
Yeah, that's a really good point, is that I was just lazy all around. I not only was a lazy student, I played basketball, but I never stepped foot into a weight room ever in high school, despite my coach telling me. And because of that, I wasn't really that good.
Yeah.
You know, I was never really that good. I never pressed myself in much of anything in high school, nor in college. So yeah, I'm sure that's actually not really something I had thought about a lot, but I was able to achieve some career success because once I got out into the real world and success was driven by somewhat how hard you worked, right? I think we all know that success is a bit about how hard you work, but a lot of it's about how smart you work. It's about how you deal with people and a lot of other things that weren't really related to anything that I learned in high school or college. That definitely informed probably my point of view. And okay, so now that I'm responsible for kids and raising them, like, what do I think about that? So yeah, it's a good point in that it didn't come through excellence in academics. And it didn't come through I never even had a job until I started college. I didn't work during the summers in high school. I did work during summers in college, you know, waiting tables and stuff like that. But it didn't come from some early work ethic or academic excellence or any of that stuff, because I didn't have much of any of that stuff as a kid.
Yeah, that's right. Hey, some of us are late bloomers. So as you think back, you know, both from your own experience and also, you know, experience raising two young adults that are past this chapter, you know, they're already into their lives and a few years out having success. Like, instead of the sort of traditional narrative that says, hey, you need to go hit these specific milestones, these are the things you need to do as a young adult in order to succeed, go to college, get good grades, get a good job, contribute to your 401k, yada, 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 all the other things that are kind of like the standard milestones. Like, what's your impression of, like, what are better targets to aim at? What are things that young adults should be aiming at? Things they should spend their time on? And not as a parent that's saying, hey, you have to go do these, but what advice would you give to that 18-year-old?
I think, well, let's start a little bit with just probably both girls brought it up like three times yesterday. They were like, if I had a dollar for every time you talked to me about growth mindset, that'd be a millionaire. So I think one thing was, is growth mindset. So I think it's not necessarily what you know, focus on doing. It's just something to try to learn, is that a lot of it is about a growth mindset of being able to learn from every situation, learn from failure, pivot, be adaptable to change, that type of thing. So I would say, as an 18-year-old, you know, worry less about, like, what you're going to be doing 25 years from now, or at the age of 25, or what your career is going to be, or what your job's going to be, or where you're going to live, because it's really hard to control any of that stuff. And just worry about what are you doing and learning and benefiting from today, and then tomorrow and the next day after that. I think a second thing is that start getting comfortable with taking calculated risk.
Yeah.
You know, is that the world doesn't really tend to reward people that are the same as everybody else. And so it's start to find ways. That doesn't mean go jump off a cliff and see what happens. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
It's how do you start to do things that are a little different, that are a little bit of a risk, not massive risks that are going to ruin your life. And then learn from doing those types of things. I think it's just, there's just a lot of pressure to follow all the rules and do the same thing everyone else is doing. And I think at 17 or 18, 19, you've got some leeway to mess up a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't do something that ruins your life, but you do something that kind of is a mistake that you made or whatever. I mean, you're 18, 19. It's okay. You got plenty of time to work through it.
Yeah.
So I think those are two things. Oh, go ahead.
Like reversible decisions. Don't make any irreversible decisions. Like,
that's a good way to say
you,
it.
You end up in jail. You've eliminated a lot of your future option set, but there's tons of wiggle room, and this is probably the freest you're going to be in your life. Go take advantage of that.
Yeah, probably. And probably a good example would be, I mentioned Brooke, you know, she was, how old was she? I think she was 19, and she decided to start a little candle making company. Mm-hmm. And so that was maybe a $1,200 or so investment to get started with that and start to do it and buy enough inventory and get moving. And she did that for 5 or 6 months and she enjoyed it. And she made a little bit of money from it, not a lot, but she also learned some things. She took some courses while she was doing that that would have bored her to tears if she was doing them in college.
Yeah.
Because she had nothing to apply it to.
Absolutely.
But because it was this thing that she started, suddenly she wanted to learn how to do accounting for a small business, for example. And ultimately, after 6 months, she started making cakes and she likes cakes better. So I think there's some people would say, well, you started that candle thing and it failed. And it's like, oh, that's not what happened, right? She just did that for a while and learned from it. And then she just decided to start something different. She's 19 years old and it's $1,000. That's a lot less of a cost. That's probably what, I don't know, 2 weeks of college.
Yeah.
So it's not that bad.
Maybe.
Maybe. So I think that's one thing. And then the third thing too, they talked to me about this, just emotional intelligence.
Yeah.
Spending some time at the age of 17, 18, and you can do it for free online. It's just understanding and learning about emotional intelligence is really important.
Do you feel like there were experiences too, you know, in their teenage years, early adulthood years that helped them level up that, like level up EQ, you know, like, so for instance, I'll give you one that I've seen quite a bit in young adults is like young adults who, I see this in particular among homeschoolers who have had a lot of exposure to people who are older than them, but they didn't go through 12 years of school regimented by people who are all the same age, but they had kind of like exposure to people who are adults in a non-authoritarian manner where it's like, I have a broader range of ability to relate to people other than just like my peer group. And that allows me to, like, I have a much more vertical rather than horizontal understanding of how other people are. And it's not just the people who are at the same level of development as me who are, you know, also, especially the younger you are, like, not developed yet. And so,
yeah,
like, you're learning from people who already have some of these things figured out at a younger age and developing at an early pace. And I'm just wondering, like, what did your girls spend their time on? Were there different activities or, you know, things they were involved in or things they did that you feel like helped them develop emotional intelligence?
Oh, I think when they were younger, I'm trying to think of some things when they're younger. I mean, there's one thing I'll come back to. I think for sure, you know, Lauren, because of the path that she took when she was 18, 19, the first full-time role that you guys helped her land at Remind, she was, she had just turned 20. And she talked about something again in the podcast a year ago that really from that age forward, she's 24 now, she'll be 25 in November. Like all she was work, she was by far the youngest person in the office. And so she was kind of like forced at the age of 20 to spend pretty much all of her time with people who were at the youngest 25, 26, and many people in their 30s. One of her best friends is in her mid 30s with two kids. And she's 20, you know, Lauren's 24 and single. So I think for sure she picked up a lot in that vertical way of being around a lot of people who were older than her at that time. Brooke, not so much, but I think I asked them about this. I keep referring to it yesterday because I talked to them forever yesterday. But, you know, I asked them about like emotional intelligence. So what are some of the things you remember? And one of the things that Lauren talked about was, and I used to do this a lot, was like, especially when they were being 14 years old and telling you that you're 40, you don't know anything, Dad. Right. Any parent who's listening to this has heard that 100 times from their kids. You don't understand. You don't know anything. And one of the things I would always use in an argument against them was, okay, you're 14, Lauren. Do you think you're smarter than you were when you were 11? Do you think you know more things than when you were 11? Do you think you like, you know, a few of those questions? And of course, yes, of course. Like, yeah, duh. And I'm like, well, see, that never stops. So when you're 17, you're going to think you were an idiot at 14.
Yeah.
And et cetera. And so that never really stopped. So, you know, you just have to kind of understand at certain ages that that what you think you know is pretty much nothing compared to what others know, and especially what other people with life experience know.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. I definitely should and could have benefited a lot from learning that at age 17.
No, they did not. They were laughing about it. They were laughing about it yesterday. Like, I hated when you did that. But then afterwards, it'd be like, oh, it's kind of right.
Yeah.
I was an idiot when I was an idiot, like, you know, 17 or 18. Yeah, I was an idiot when I'm 14. Okay. Well, just know that when you're 22, you're going to think you were an idiot now. So well, you just remember that.
I'm not sure about the development of girls, but I know for boys, it's like age 17, 18, you're like as cocky as you'll ever be. And then
oh my goodness,
in the next dozen plus years and probably in perpetuity after this, like
totally
cemented, you know, how stupid you were at that age.
I still remember a long talk with Brooke when she was in eighth grade or seventh grade, that there's probably nothing dumber than a seventh grade boy. I was like, if you knew your dad in the seventh grade, you would be so embarrassed. So embarrassed. But one other thing just popped in my head too. I remember us doing this a lot, is we would have conversations around emotional intelligence. I want you to think back to something maybe even 3 or 6 months ago, or even a year ago, that you were very emotionally charged about, especially teenagers. They can come up with 5 things that angered you or made you tremendously happy or whatever. And now, right now, today, what does that event mean to you? And usually what they'd say, like, they'd be like, yeah, I don't even ever think about it. Right. And think about how much you put into it at the moment. And now 6 months later, it's not even anything that really you think about. And that's a lot of what emotional intelligence is. It's understanding that this moment is only so big and it too shall pass. And you just kind of take it in a bit more of a calm manner, because if you kind of can train yourself to know that. We talked about that a lot when they were teenagers, because they were very emotional as teenagers.
Yeah. Yeah. As teenagers are, you know. So outside of the emotional intelligence, you know, what are some other things that either the girls did well, or just advice off the cuff that, you know, you'd point the average 17, 18 year old, or their parents, you know, what are some other things you can focus on that are valuable without being told what to do?
I think for sure, one is back to what you and I were talking about before, is just, I feel like when I ask a lot of teenagers, what's the goal? Like, what do you want to do? You know, when you grow up, like, the first thing they all talk about is money. Mm. It is just money, 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 money. And some of that's the society we live in or what have you. But I think the thing they would both kind of tell you that I think they did well at that age was, like, it's focused more on doing the types of things that if you do them really well, consistently, it always ends up leading to money.
Yeah.
And so focus more on the foundational skills and the things that people value. And if you do those things, trust me, it will turn into money later.
Yeah.
But if you chase money, you will make bad decisions, because you will try to impatiently attain it before you've earned it. So I think they both did that well. I think they both did a good job of building friends and relationships. You know, I think they both had good friends. Like, they were around stable, good people who helped them make good decisions, because they ain't going to listen to their parents a lot of times.
Yeah.
They're going to listen to the 16-year-old that they're hanging out with. And they did a good job of that. And I think the third thing they did is then, in addition to that, they did a good job in maintaining their relationship with their parents. Like, they very rarely can I think of when I felt like a time where, oh my gosh, we're losing them, or they don't ever talk to us or anything. There was always a lot of continuous communication with their parents. And a lot of kids don't do that. They value their friends' opinions more than their parents. And I give them a lot of credit for, didn't mean we were always right, but I feel like I remember so many times, at least they would ask the opinion of a decision they were getting ready to make.
Yeah, that's a good way. I mean, good lines, open lines of communication to have. I know a lot of parents struggle with that. A lot of young adults struggle with that. I know I struggled with that with my parents until I finally realized, hey, I don't know everything. You probably do know more than me about a lot of stuff, which probably was like age 25 for me. So it could be really,
it's valuable. Really, like, it's And it's so hard not to, it's so hard not to tell them what to do, because a lot of times when you tell them what to do, they're just going to try to do the opposite. So it was, you know, it was trying to figure out ways to get them to conclude what you felt like you knew. You know, yeah. If I just tell them this, they're probably not going to do it. If I can somehow get them to be, to conclude it, then it's like, oh, really? Is that what you decided? Right. Yeah. But they, yeah, I think those, you know, when you ask that question, those are the things that, that pop into mind.
Yeah. So I want to ask another question that's a little bit more direct advice here. So if, you know, your daughter, one of your daughters came to you at age 17 and was like, Dad, what do I need to do to have the option to do whatever I want to do? Like, what do I need to be focusing on? What do I need to develop? Like, is there a certain set of skills or a certain mindset, or like, what do I need to do at age 17, 18, early 20s to make sure that I am set up for success in the future?
There's two things that pop in my head right away when you started to ask that question. The first thing is focus on always creating scarce value. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is never be afraid of change. Mm.
Yeah. What? Okay. So let's go down that track on both of those.
Unpack like, those a little bit.
Yeah. Let's unpack those. Scarce value. What does that mean? How do I go about developing scarce value?
Yeah, it's just it's a term. Like if you, Mitchell, need something, mm-hmm. that's important to you, and I can deliver that to you, it's valuable. But I live in Charlotte and you live in Oklahoma. And if there's 10 other people who live within 3 miles of you who can deliver the same value I can, then it's not scarce.
Yep.
Right. So being able to deliver value to somebody is somewhat important, but if it's not scarce, it doesn't really matter. And if you deliver something that's scarce, if I can deliver something to you and I'm the only person in the world, like I can tell you all 15 guys on the Charlotte Hornets roster. I can do that. I don't think you value that.
No.
And there's not a lot of people who can do it. So it's scarce, but it's not valuable.
Yep.
And so it's the combination of the two. And so scarce value is different from being good at something. So just because you're good at something doesn't mean that it's valuable to someone. And so I think a lot of kids in their 16, 17, 18, they're being told, figure out what you're good at and turn that into a career. Yep. And I don't know that I necessarily agree with that.
Follow your passion.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So scarce value is, and it's the last thing is that delivering scarce value is hard to do over a long period of time. So if you do something really well and you're the only person that does it, you're probably going to get paid a lot of money. But guess what? There's other people who are going to figure that out.
Yep.
And so competition comes in, or technology gets developed and suddenly technology replaces what you were providing. And so that leads to the second thing of not being afraid of change. So the second thing is always be looking for unique and different ways to add scarce value. And if you hit a certain point where you're struggling to deliver scarce value in what you're doing, just pivot to something else.
Yeah.
You know, you're never going to lack options. So I don't know if that's tangible enough, but that's definitely, we have had a ton of conversations, you know, father to daughter about those types of situations of scarce value. And there's a funny story about when Lauren, one of Lauren's teachers that was in high school that fits to that, but we can get into that at some point.
Yeah, no, well, it's here. I was going to ask, like, what are some tangible ways, you know, as you think to give a little bit more actionable, here's what you should do at age 18 to go start down this journey of developing scarce value and learning how to be valuable to other people. Like, what are some actual action items, some actual steps you could take if you're somebody who knows, I want to figure out how to do that. Whether making money is the goal or just having career optionality is the goal, whatever the driving force is, I want to develop scarce value. I'm buying into your mindset, Seth. How do I go do that?
Well, one of them we started talking about before, emotional intelligence. I think I do not meet a lot of people that I feel like have really good emotional intelligence, and it is valuable and it's scarce. So that's the first thing. And that leads to a lot of different ways that sometimes you add value just by that ability. You're one of the few people who can sit in the middle of chaos and be calm.
Yeah.
That's valuable. And I think a lot of people would be like, oh, please. And it's like, no, trust me. As someone who manages a lot of people, where there's a lot of decisions and a lot of chaos and a lot of noise. Oh my goodness. Is that valuable? The second thing is attitude. If you learn how to create a positive your attitude is positive. You listen a lot more than you talk. You just take on what's asked of you with determination and will. You don't complain. You don't whine. You're helpful. Oh my gosh, is that so valuable? Because it's like, I grew up playing sports. Like I said, I wasn't any good at sports, but man, did I see how one bad attitude could really ruin a locker room.
Yep.
And how one, a leader who didn't necessarily have to be the best player could totally make a locker room.
Yep.
And the chemistry and how important attitude was. That's the second thing. And I think the last thing would be, again, we used to talk about this a lot, even when Lauren started her first job that you guys helped her get, was how are you going to create unexpected value? Mm. What's a gap that's not being filled? What's a problem that you overheard the CEO talking about? What's something in the business that you saw that's broken? I don't think a lot of people pay attention to those things because they grew up being rule followers. Here's your job description. Do yep. this job, stay in your lane. And what I feel like I always tried to tell them is, nah, it's not, you got to do that to check those boxes.
Yeah.
But the way you really create scarce value is you look for all the opportunities to add value inside of an entity that other people aren't doing. And you do that a few times and you become super, super valuable. And again, it's very scarce.
Yeah. And I mean, you don't even have to be in the professional setting to apply those same concepts. I mean,
oh, definitely not.
Like,
yeah.
You can be bagging groceries and take those same, you know, same principles, like go be the person who's greeting everybody that walks into the grocery store, you know, be the bagger that's chatty and nice and polite to the people standing in line. Memorize where everything in the grocery store is so that you can tell guests when they ask, hey, do you know where X item is? Like, you can offer those kinds of.
Those are all so good. Exactly. I think exactly. Those are great examples. And, you know, again, I think people are like, well, if they're not going to pay me to memorize where everything is in the grocery store, why do it? I think that, you know, we talked about money, is that stop making everything. You can't make everything transactional.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to have a little bit of patience.
Yep.
And if you build and do those types of things, then eventually what happens is the manager gets told 6 or 7 times that Mitchell kid is amazing. He helped me find peanut butter in a way that no other kid did.
Yep.
And that sounds dumb, but at some point that manager says, this is the kind, this kid Mitchell, who's 16, I have turnover every week. These kids aren't responsible. This is a kid I need to keep.
Yep.
This is the kind of employee I want. And that's what you want to do.
Yep. And it's the same thing for the rest of your career. Like, be that kind
Completely.
Of, become that type of person. So I wanted to get your take on this too. So there's a transition point. If you're that young adult, you know, you're coming out of high school, you decide, let's say you decide not to go to college, and mm-hmm. you're running this playbook of, I want to build scarce value. I'm building skills. Maybe I've got some work experience. I'm still trying to figure out what I want to do. Like, how do you move beyond the jobs that are accessible today to you as an 18-year-old into this great big world of opportunity? How do you go get your foot in the door at cool opportunities, get somebody to take a chance on you, and believe, hey, this kid is worth taking a shot on. They say that they can, you know, they can work hard. They have scarce value to offer. How do you make that leap as an 18-year-old, especially somebody who may not have a college degree? So you kind of have like the deck stacked against you in the world today. To some degree, not having the credentials.
I think this is what in the business they refer to as a rhetorical question, because I know you already know the answer.
well, I do this for a living, so I can tell kids how to do this all the day, but I want to get your take as a parent and also somebody who had two daughters who hit it out of the park.
I've heard you talk about this. It's network, man. It is, you know, it's building a network of people like that grocery store manager who, even after you've moved on, knows somebody who works at some business who said, man, I wish I could find a young up-and-comer that would do such and so. And they go, this kid who worked for me 2 years ago, that's the person you need to talk to. And again, people will say, oh, that doesn't really happen. No, that happens all the time. I've been hiring people for 15 years now. I have never, ever hired a person that did not start and come through my network, ever. It is always based on someone who, you know, when I need to fill a role, it's reach out to people I know and trust and say, this is the kind of person and skill set and attitude that I need. Do you know anybody?
Yeah.
And that is how I hire. And that's how most people do it too. And so I think that can feel daunting to a 17 or 18 year old, or they feel like, I know I need to build a network, and that's what I'll do in college.
Yeah.
College is about enabling. It's a built-in network. Yeah, it is. I mean, it's a, you're building a network with a bunch of people. You're building a network with basically two types of people, a bunch of people who are your age and doing the same thing you are.
Yep.
And the professors who actually aren't, they aren't the ones that are hiring.
Yeah.
You're not going to get a job working for one of those professors. So that doesn't hurt. But I think you're going to be much better off starting to build a network of people who eventually turn into referrers for you.
Yeah. Well, whether you go to college or not, it's the same thing that I tell, you know, the young adults that I do know who are in college, is like, you're back to what I was talking about, horizontal versus vertical. Like, your horizontal mm-hmm. network is worth nothing to you for probably 10 years. Like, they've got to go out and they've got to get jobs.
That's very true.
They've got to go climb the ranks, and then you can call on them and, you know, tap on them. They've built some credibility. You may hire some of them, but they're not going to get you your first job out of college. You've got to build that vertical network as well, that extends beyond your peers and into the real world, and people that they can help you make that transition into the real world more smoothly. You said something else. Go ahead.
Yeah, we should definitely talk, because I keep going on this topic, right? Because then there's what do I actually do? Okay, fine, Mitchell and Seth.
Yeah.
I want to build a network. I'm 17 or 18 years old. Like, okay, what does that mean? What do I do?
Yeah. Well, you brought something up interesting about, you know, in 15 years of hiring, you've found all those people from your network. And one of the things you're talking about earlier about scarce value is this is where I think you have multiple levers working in your advantage as a young adult, is this idea of pairing up scarce value with a network that knows about the scarce value you can offer. Because when Seth emails his network, and he says, hey, I've got this opening, I'm looking for somebody that knows XYZ thing. And if you're a young professional and you look like everybody else, your name is not going to be the one that comes to mind when somebody gets the email of, hey, I'm looking for XYZ person, unless you're, you know, I'm looking for 50 sales reps and you happen to be a sales rep. But if, like, the more valuable the role, the more specific the value that you can offer, the more scarce that value is, and you become known for that, you become the first person that comes to mind in the network you're building for the things that you're good at, which opens up opportunities, even without you having to go search for those on your own. It sort of creates that network effect of amplifying the value you can create by building that reputation among a ton of other people that can almost market for you the skill set that you have.
I could not agree more with you. And I'll say this. When somebody says, oh, you have to talk to this person or that person, I shouldn't say never. Like, I'm being overly dramatic. I don't recall in any of those conversations, the reason I'm referring this person to you, it's because they had a 4.4 GPA in high school and they graduated from blah, blah college.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is never why they tell me that I said never again, stop it. So why do you recommend them? Oh my gosh. And what they end up telling me is the things we've been talking about, mm-hmm. the calm under pressure. They make good decisions. They go out of their way and do stuff that adds value. They solve one of the biggest problems that we had had in the business and they weren't even asked, or their attitude's awesome.
Yeah.
They make other people better. Just that. That's what you hear when people refer. It's also very rarely about, well, they have a lot of knowledge, you know, or they have a lot of information. It's really, you just don't really hear that much. Yeah. It's just about the things that they do in ways that are different. That's right. And nobody opens a encyclopedia. So yeah, I think I totally agree with you. It's so much about that. And like, there are hires that I make that are through a recruiting agency, mm-hmm. but I really only work with one recruiting agency. So I think a lot of companies have lots of different recruiting agencies.
Yeah.
I have one that we have gotten to know each other really, really well. They've gotten to know our business really well. And when they refer someone, I know at a minimum on a scale of 1 to 10, they're referring a 7 every time.
Yeah.
And so it's not necessarily someone who came out of my personal network. It's from a network of people I trust.
Yeah. Yeah, which is just as important. I mean, that's a proxy for valuable signal. Is
it's this not other just person friends and gets, family? Kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So you're a 17, 18 year old. You're listening to us guys chumming up about how to go be successful, how to develop scarce value, you know, build a network, get your foot in the door. But like, how do you actually go out there and build the network? And, you know, getting your foot in the door is one thing, but how do you go grow the network with the types of people that you want to be around without it being cheesy, without being the guy who's showing up with business card, you know, with a bunch of business cards and handing them out and calling that network? Like, how do you go build a strong, valuable professional network for yourself as a young adult who's just starting out?
Yeah, it's a good one. And it's one that, again, Lauren's done a lot of this. Brooke really hasn't. Brooke never wanted to be a career girl. So building a network is not that big of a deal to her. It has been a big deal to Lauren. So I did ask Lauren, I've asked Lauren a lot about this. And there's a really funny story from when she was waiting tables that we'll get into around this. But she told me, and I jotted it down when she told me, I didn't know this. She told me that she was listening to YouTube videos and took a couple of online courses when she was 17 or 18 on charisma. So what she, you know, she was hearing this networking kind of message from me. Yeah. And one of the things that she sort of observed is even in high school, a lot of the most popular kids were obviously the best looking kids or most athletic, but then there was a lot of popular kids that were so charismatic.
Yep.
And we watched Ferris Bueller together, Ferris Bueller's Day Off together. I don't know if you know that movie.
Yeah.
But we did watch that together when she was like 17, and she's referred back to that, like, talk about a guy with charisma. So building a network is a lot about how quickly you can just form a quick relationship with someone, where someone wants to just spend a little bit of extra time with you. And a lot about that is charisma, you know, just your ease with which you hold a conversation. So I would tell 17 or 18 year olds that was really great that she did that. It's just learn how to be charismatic, and it is a learnable skill. I think the second thing is that it's paying attention to and observing successful people who are in your bubble, you know, so not athletes and entertainers on TV, please don't focus on that.
Seriously.
You are going to come across like it's the, you know, your best friend's mom who started a business and is crushing it, and talk to her, you know, just talk to her. And that can start with just learning from her, but start by learning from her, which eventually could turn into her saying, kid is really smart. Like, I'm going to recommend her to a friend of mine named Seth, who just asked for an intern in his BDR organization.
Yep.
So that's a second thing that you can start doing, is just pay attention to those things. I don't see a lot of kids do that. And when you come across someone like that, stop and spend some time with them and ask them how they got where they are. Introduce yourself and speak with them. And then last is, as soon as you can, create a LinkedIn profile. Pay somebody. It's worth it probably to pay somebody a little bit of money to help you make it really strong and make it impactful when people land on it. And then every time you do something that matters, or anytime you do something that added value, put it on there. And it will not take long before you will start getting connection requests, especially as you start to get into things from recruiters. And something I always told Lauren, I think we talked about it, is never, ever, ever ignore a recruiter. Like, always respond, thank them for reaching out and build relationships, because her first job that she got, you guys helped her get, which she'll say, like, the first job's the hardest one to get, but her second, it really is. But her second and third job, she had value that she had created that she could talk about, and she had built a network. And the United Airlines job, 100, which she loves. She loves working for United. It's an awesome company. That came from network. Someone in her network that reached out and said, hey, they're looking to hire somebody like you. And it required 5 years of experience. She had less than 3 and still got the job, right? Because it was me having somebody I trust saying, you got to talk to this person. And I know you need 5 years and she's only got 3. You still need to talk to her.
Yep.
And that's how that job started.
Yeah.
So really, it's really those 3 things. I think if you can start there, it'll start to build quicker than you think it will.
I think one of the things, so this triggered me thinking back to, you know, several different thoughts here when I cover, but I think one of the things that's hard to understand as a young adult, the value of the network is, other people in your network know about opportunities that are good for you that you don't know about yet.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
And if they don't know what you're capable of, like we were just talking about, they can't open the door for you. But there's also tremendous value in, like, as you're growing the network, that's that many more people that know about exciting things that they can help you get your foot in the door to doors that you probably can't access yourself. Not just because you don't know about them, but because in many cases, there's restrictions that that would preclude you otherwise. Yeah. I think some crazy stat. I know you said, you know, you've never made a hire outside of some kind of indirect or direct network connection. But I think there's a crazy stat, something like 80% of all jobs in the United States are never even posted. They're hired from either internally in the company or from the network of somebody in the company before they're ever even a job posting. It's like, if you're a young person, you're listening to this, like, don't shrug it off and just say, hey, I'm going to go to college and I'm going to build a friend group there, and that's going to pave the way for me. Because it truly is like one of the most exponentially valuable things in terms of the flow of opportunities to your email inbox and your phone that you don't know about. The people that, you know, you interact with and are aware of the value that you can create, growing your network is going to open up more doors for you than all the books you could read or all the credentials you could get. So,
it's fine. Like, and I was curious.
Yeah.
I just opened up Lauren's LinkedIn page. So, you know, she's 24 years old. She's 3.5 years into a career, but she's where, what, she would have been a year and a half out of college if she'd gone to college. And she has 383 connections on her LinkedIn page. And I'm just scrolling through them here. People from Amazon, Google, Facebook, Apple, VP of Revenue Operations, Director of People, like just all kinds of people in all kinds of different areas. So 380 plus people that she's at least connected with and gotten to know. As we all, maybe half of them can think of her right off the top of their head, maybe a third of them.
Yeah.
But even if it's a third of them, that's 100 people in a moment when somebody says, you know anybody that's good at such and so? Yeah, this girl, Lauren Marlowe. Yeah, yep. Talk to her. Well, and that's the whole, like, don't worry about chasing the paycheck right away. If you do a lot of these things, it always comes back to you.
You brought up another point about the LinkedIn, and I think about this idea of, you know, all of our apprentices, they build out their digital footprint. They build a portfolio. They're updating their LinkedIns. They're like creating this body of work around the skill set that they have. But I even know in my experience, and I'm sure this is probably true for you with as much hiring as you've done, is I will think back through my network of people and, you know, people that I know, or when I have somebody ask me for a specific, do you know mm-hmm. somebody who can do X, or I'm hiring for X? And I'll go scroll through my LinkedIn connections.
Yep.
And I'll see somebody's face. I'll see their name. I'll go click on their profile. And first of all, if it's not updated, like, that makes it more difficult for me to recollect, what are you good at? But like, usually
makes it hard for you to recommend them too.
Yeah.
It makes it hard for you to recommend them, because if you recommend them to me, you know, I'm going to go to their LinkedIn.
Exactly.
And if their LinkedIn profile is not up to date, or it's a little sloppy, or it's a little whatever, I'm kind of like, "This will do." Like,
you don't want to have that gut reaction of like, "I don't know if I want to send this person over." So that's just a good reminder too, like being proactive about those things, and don't put yourself in a situation where it's like, you know, you're suddenly looking for a job, and now you've got to spend, which is already stressful enough, now you got to spend all this time to go update these things that you could have done all along by being proactive about them. So. We've covered a lot of stuff here so far. I want to just kind of recap with you. What are some of your kind of closing thoughts, bullet points you want to make sure that, you know, young adults, parents listening to this, they walk away with?
All right. Summary. How do I summarize? growth mindset and confidence.
Yeah.
Just a growth mindset and confidence, and it being less, stop comparing yourself so much to others. Stop comparing yourself to your 28-year-old self. And just experience things and learn from them and have confidence. Overinvest in emotional intelligence and charisma. And again, some people are just born with that. They're both learned skills. You can learn how to be emotionally intelligent. You can learn how to be charismatic. Don't worry about money yet. The money will come. Focus on doing the things that lead to scarce value for others. And last, if the simplest way to get started is to start paying attention to and building a network. As you get to know people, it sounds like an empty promise, but as you get to know people, opportunity will follow. And then what you do with that opportunity matters. You got to create scarce value, but opportunity will follow. And then two other things we didn't kind of get into, but there's two things that I had jotted down. One is, you know, I think so many 18-year-olds are worried, you know, where am I going to go to college? What am I going to major in? What's my career going to be? And it's like, if you really think you're going to do one thing for the rest of your life, my goodness, you're not. And if you think you need to figure it out at 18 or 19, don't worry about that. The thing I would say is everyone is great at something, or will be, usually multiple things. Every one of us, you're great at something, and whatever, a lot of, and you're great at more than one thing, and you'll be able to translate those things into a career. And the second thing is, I think there's a misunderstanding. I think young kids especially think there's such a limited number of opportunities. There's such a limited number of great jobs, or there's such a limited number of ways to make money. And oh my God, like the opposite is so true.
Yeah.
There are countless ways to create scarce value. You just have to look for them. And when you're basically spending all your time just following the rules and doing what people are telling you, you are totally not looking for those opportunities. And that's why you don't think they're out there.
Definitely. I love that idea. I love that last point, especially like the idea of an abundance mindset. There's tons of cool stuff if you just look. Seth, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
You as well, Mitchell. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. All our listeners out there, thanks again for listening. Check out Self-Directed. We'll be back again soon with another episode.